This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Catherine Fritke, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of September 18th, here are a few top stories. In the news, this story came from the streets of Mexico City, as our Mexico City reporters brought you the latest news in the hours and days after the earthquake this week. One area of the city that suffered severe impacts was a school and a college, which witnessed death and destruction, but also signs of solidarity and support. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Rodrigo Cervantes reports.
The sounds of rubble being removed remind one of the crumbling sounds of buildings collapsing the day before. At least 250 people have died in Mexico after the earthquake, almost half of them in Mexico City. And plenty of people have also lost their place to live, to work, to study. While some buildings fell immediately, some still standing are severely damaged, like the one the rescuer is talking about. It's an apartment building with a facade cracked and tilted. I am at the south of Mexico City in Coapa, one of the most affected areas after the earthquake. Roads are closed and debris is here and there. And wherever you find damage, you will most probably find traffic brought by hundreds of citizens trying to help. Some of them bring equipment, others bring food, water, or medical supplies. As I approach to one of the most terrifying scenes left by the earthquake, volunteers ask for oxygen tanks. There's a school that fell almost entirely, leaving several children, teenagers, and adults trapped, injured, and dead. Rescuers working at the destroyed school constantly ask everyone to be still and quiet. They need silence, either to communicate among them or to try to find any hint, any sound that could prove that someone is still alive under the debris. It is very uncertain at this point how many are still buried at the Enrique Repsamen school. Dozens of bodies have been pulled out of the rubble already, and fewer are found alive. Volunteers cheer every time there's a sign that someone has been found alive or has been rescued. Andrea Enriqueta is a student preparing sandwiches with other volunteers in a supermarket near the affected areas.
So we decided to donate our things to this place in which we are collecting and making bags of food. And this is how I end up here.
Andrea's college was also severely damaged, the Tec de Monterrey Mexico City campus. The facades of the Tec's building show the scars of the earthquake. Some of them have holes, others lost some windows. Five students died here. Like other places damaged by the earthquake, this university is trying to go back to normal as soon as possible. And among the people helping is Federico Rocha, a student still covered with dust.
I took out three persons, one with life, two were dead. And it was a really shock for me, because I wasn't expecting to see that. You know, it's horrible.
Federico is shaking. He's been working for more than 24 hours and wants to take a break. And wherever I go, I find plenty of people trying to help. Some ride in trucks, others on bikes, and some other walk, like Elsa Camacho, who carries a cardboard sign offering support to people with nervous breakdowns. Elsa is a psychologist and says that she gets nervous with everything she sees on her way. Yes, there's been sadness and grief in Mexico City, but most importantly, there's been a display of benevolence and kindness. Rodrigo Cervantes, KJZZ News, Mexico City.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From our Fronteras desk, we begin our occasional series called A Poisoned People. Here is the first story. 2 years ago, the town of Sanders, Arizona, learned their drinking water was toxic. The school district installed a water filtration system this summer, but many people are sick with conditions linked to uranium contamination, and no one has cleaned it up. From the Fronteras desk in Flagstaff, KJZZ's Laurel Morales reports.
What if you woke up one day to the news that the water you had been drinking most of your life could be killing you? That's what happened to Mary Lynch.
Then I found out that the middle school had the highest content of uranium, which is where I taught for 15 years.
Did you drink the water there?
I did. I drank the water. My kids drank the water. My kids all went to school here.
On her desk, she has pictures of all six of her children, including two foster kids.
Currently, I'm dealing with thyroid cancer. My daughter has colon rectal cancer.
Light scars on her neck reveal where a doctor removed her thyroid. Just after her diagnosis, researchers tested the water and found that for more than a decade, the average concentration of uranium in the water was about 50 parts per billion, way higher than the 30 parts per billion federal limit. And now the Lynches are hamstrung with medical bills.
It's been tough on our family. It was tough for just me. But then when my daughter was diagnosed, that was...
The school's water had the highest levels of uranium.
They don't train you how to handle these kinds of things in superintendent school. It's like, not on my list here, folks, sorry.
Dan Hute is the school superintendent. He shows me around the elementary school. The Arizona Department of Environmental Quality told Hute the water is toxic. It's okay to drink, but not for extended periods. Hute didn't take any chances.
You can see here that our fountains are off.
They are.
The hand washing is on, and we ended up putting bottled water and, you know, the dispensers in every one of our classrooms.
From 1944 to 1986, mining companies blasted 30 million tons of uranium out of Navajo land. The federal government purchased the ore to make atomic weapons. As the Cold War threat weakened, the companies left, abandoning 521 mines. Since then, many Navajo people have died of kidney failure and cancer, conditions linked to uranium contamination. Some 600 people live in the tiny town of Sanders, and Hute says everyone knows someone who's sick. Hute drives me to the new water filtration system. It's one thing to put in a filter, he says, but they're still living with the contamination.
God, you know, I have been aggravated. I've been really disenchanted with the bureaucracy, the complete failure to acknowledge anything on the federal side. Everybody just wants to bury their head in the sand and ignore it.
Over the last decade, the federal government has assessed the hundreds of abandoned mines on Navajo land and prioritized 46 based on high radiation levels and close proximity to homes. The U.S. Government Accountability Office estimates that millions of gallons of water contaminated by mill tailings were released into groundwater through unlined ponds. So far, the EPA has actually cleaned up only 9 mines, including one upstream of Sanders, Church Rock. In 1979, a dam breach at the Church Rock mine spilled 94 million gallons of radioactive waste into the Puerco River. That river runs right through Sanders. Navajo Council Delegate Raymond Smith Jr. says cleaning up the mine is progress, but what about the groundwater?
How do we address that? How do we prevent this from continuing to be a problem?
Smith says everybody is pointing a finger at someone else. The federal government has been trying to hold the mining companies accountable, but many have gone bankrupt. 3 companies have reached multi-million dollar settlements for the cleanup of about 150 abandoned mines. At this rate, cleanup of the Navajo Nation will likely take decades. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, reporting in Sanders.
And now, a segment from KJZZ's original production, The Show. Here's Steve Goldstein.
30 years ago, U2 was on the cusp of becoming arguably the biggest band in the world. They were on tour in support of their newest album, The Joshua Tree. The tour began in the Valley at ASU's Activity Center, now Wells Fargo Arena, and it ended here as well, in a much larger venue, Sun Devil Stadium. For some, the album epitomized U2's interpretation of what the United States was, and the Desert Southwest was part of that. And Arizona's political scene linked to the band as well. One of its better-known songs at the time of 1987 was Pride in the Name of Love, which was about Martin Luther King Jr. At that time, the state was in the midst of a national controversy caused by Governor Evan Meekum rescinding an executive order that created a Martin Luther King Jr. holiday in Arizona. And before one of their 1987 performances in the Valley, U2 announced it had donated to a Meekum impeachment fund. With me to talk about U2's history with the Valley is freelance music writer Jason P. Woodbury. Jason, the timing of U2 coming to Arizona is especially interesting. Were they on the cusp of international stardom at that point, but not quite there yet?
Yeah, so this was, really right before they exploded. It's probably when they were in the process of exploding. The Joshua Tree, I think, turned them into arguably the world's most well-known rock band, probably the biggest band in the world for a while.
See the stone set in your eyes. See the thorn twist in your side. I'll wait for you.
So they started that tour in Tempe with two shows on April 2nd and April 4th. And then they concluded the tour back in Tempe again. And by this point, they had moved to Sun Devil Stadium.
So from 15,000 people to 70,000.
Yeah, and I was so, thinking about it as a story, few things can illustrate the kind of what happened over the course of that tour than that series of shows to start off where they did and end up where they did. The Joshua Tree is really a record about, I think, these four Irish guys' conception of America, their idea of America. And it was originally, when they were working on the record, they were going to call it The Two Americas at first. That was the original title. Mm-hmm. And I think that they viewed it as there was this sort of divide between the mythic America and the real America. So I think that their attraction to Arizona is an interesting one. Arizona represents sort of the West as a concept for you two.
And it's not even just the West. It really feels like a desert motif, which you touch on in the piece, too.
Yeah, I think they were, it wasn't recorded in the desert, but I think that they were trying to conjure up some of the same space of the desert. I think if you listen close enough, the guitarist, if you listen closely to his guitar stuff, you can hear some elements of, there's obviously some country and Western, and then there's a little bit of kind of Duane Eddy twang. They were trying to evoke the desert, in a way with the Joshua Tree.
Now, one question that's not specifically about the Joshua Tree, but does play into Arizona a little bit. You mentioned April 4 being one of the dates, and that is a date that is very important to their song Pride,
right,
which talks about Martin Luther King. And, of course, Arizona had the fight over Martin Luther King Day, which you two got involved in.
They were thinking about America. They were thinking about America in kind of a grand sense. I think they were obsessed with the idea of America. And I think in their view and in the songs, I think he represents the idea of the best of America, sort of the most just, the most righteous idea of America. So when they showed up, we were in the midst of a really weird situation here where the governor, Evan Meekum, had canceled, Martin Luther King Jr. Day as a paid holiday. And a lot of bands, a lot of people boycotted Arizona. The Doobie Brothers.
Stevie Wonder.
Stevie Wonder was a very vocal guy. And, Public Enemy, a couple years later, recorded By the Time I Get to Arizona, and they boycotted the state until 2006.
Wow.
So Public Enemy, so that's sort of the climate in which U2 arrives. These guys who've written songs about MLK and have expressed this fervent admiration for him. So they show up in the midst of all this. They did not cancel the tour here. Instead, they showed up. They announced via the promoter that they were going to donate money to Meekum's recall campaign to get him out of office, which it did. That happened.
Right.
That happened just over a year after they showed up. And I'm sure that you two would love it if we said that they were solely responsible for that. That's not the case. But I think that they kind of showed up at this charged moment. And I think that they addressed that moment. I think they took it head on. And I think it was their way of showing up and saying, we're going to put our money where our mouths are. And we're going to kind of show up and own this controversy in a way.
Jason P. Woodbury is a freelance music writer here in the Valley. We've been talking about the Joshua Tree Tour. U2 is here in the Valley tonight. Jason, thanks.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to KJZZ, and this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From our science desk, the American Society of Civil Engineers has given America's roads a D rating. But trying to raise that grade without accounting for climate change could put the country's roadways at risk. From the Arizona Science Desk, KJZZ's Nicholas Gerbis reports.
When building or fixing a road, civil engineers choose materials rated for the local climate. Not today's climate, not tomorrow's either, but the one that prevailed from 1964 to 1995. Now, a study in Nature Climate Change says that could be a costly mistake. Civil engineering expert Shane Underwood, formerly of Arizona State University, led the study.
If we're using the wrong grade, then the roads will not last as long, and if the roads don't last as long, then there's a cost of that, an actual economic cost.
That could run into the tens of billions nationwide, paid mainly by cities and towns. Arizona would fall into the bottom third of states affected. The Midwest and Southeast would be the hardest hit. But it's not just the future. The study found that engineers had chosen the wrong pavement grades in 35% of recent projects. Nicholas Gerbis, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally, in business news, One Valley Hospital is expanding. Here's KJZZ's Steve Goldstein.
Phoenix Children's Hospital has built an international reputation for providing some of the best pediatric care in the world, but space has been tight. The facility was built to accommodate 22,000 patients a year, but PCH has been serving more than 80,000. A $40 million expansion that officially becomes a reality tomorrow will dramatically increase the size of its emergency department and Level 1 pediatric trauma center. That will allow the hospital to serve 100,000 patients annually, and it's also expected to dramatically increase efficiency, in part by tripling the number of private exam rooms. Also, a new CT scan will make it possible to diagnose and treat patients more quickly. Earlier, I visited PCH and spoke with pediatric surgeon Dr. Kathy Van Leeuwen about the facility's changes. I started by asking her specifically why the CT scan was such an integral part of what PCH wants to improve and accomplish.
So this is a collaboration that our radiology department has made with Philips. And it's, now Philips, when they make new things, so this is like anybody, like GE, Philips, these companies, they want to be able to collaborate with an institution that's going to use it a lot. So we have the volume to basically trial any equipment. It's not an experimental machine. It's just a machine that works faster, but it also gives them a lot of data. Think about like the Tesla and how, you know, Elon Musk wants everybody to drive Teslas, but they also want everybody to use the features in the Tesla. It's just like your Apple phone. All of that data is going back to those companies for quality improvement. So we are using the highest tech possible CT scanner, which only allows that company to make things even more high tech. If they don't have the patients to use it, or, you know, the volume of patients to use it, then the hospitals aren't going to be helpful to them. We're the early adopter for something that is really cool. These are very quick scans. CT scans used to take a long time, and it resulted in a lot of radiation exposure to a child. Now we use a program called Image Gently, which allows for a very, very small amount of radiation to be delivered, very focused on what area of the body. And so whether you're getting a head CT, a CT spine of your neck, your chest, your abdomen, we can kind of focus in, and it's not as much radiation exposure.
So PCH attracts the best of the best, and the reputation is worldwide now. Why is that?
So Phoenix Children's is a new place, and Arizona is a young state. And so this is very exciting for doctors to come and build something. And you can go to a huge hospital on the East Coast and not have any impact long-term in how things changed in that town. I'm from Phoenix. I was born and raised here. My dad had 10,000 chickens in Levine, which we no longer have a chicken farm. But I love the town. I love Phoenix. I love the idea that I can come to Phoenix Children's, which is a growing institution that in the 12 years I've been here has expanded like I would have never dreamed, and I get to be part of that. So when Phoenix Children's, and when Phoenix in general, attracts people like me who want to stay here and want to watch something grow, that's amazing.
And does that guarantee innovation, just that in and of itself?
I think so. So I think the type of people who want to come here and be part of something new are thinking outside of the box. They're not just wanting things to be the same old, same old. They're adaptable. They're malleable. So if someone comes to you and says, hey, there's this new treatment for something, and believe it or not, the way you're doing it is completely out of date now, you have to say, okay, sounds good. I'm on board. Show me how to do that. A lot of doctors aren't comfortable with that because they're trained to do something and they want to do it that way forever. So people in Phoenix are going to be more flexible, more malleable.
How different is it for a children's hospital when you work with architects and designers? How much input did the physicians have in this?
So the people who build hospitals in this country, it's a small group of very big companies. And when it comes time to actually decide how to build a hospital, we have our hospital builder. His name is Dave Cottle. And Dave built this whole place. And so when it came time to build this emergency room, he was able to use his connections, interview different companies, and decide. And yes, so what they do is they'll visit other emergency rooms in other cities, and Dave will go with them and say, this looks similar to what we want, but it's different, you know, where we are. So the different things that we have to think about is, where are our patients coming from? How many are coming in through an ambulance bay? How many are coming in on a helicopter pad? So we have to look at volume and flow. We also have to look at just, how are we in Phoenix? What's our spirit? You know, how do we act with our families? We are a very family-friendly hospital, so we have to be prepared that when someone comes into the trauma bay, that you have their entire family, and then you have somebody to help the family. So the doctors are paying attention to the child. No one expects the doctors, other than giving the family up-to-date information, they don't expect them to be sitting with the family, comforting the family. For sure, the family wants to see the doctor focusing on their child. But it's such a traumatic experience that you have to have room, and you have to have some sort of environment that's not scary, that's calming, that's comforting. And so we definitely push those issues when we talk to the architects. We also do a lot of benchmarking. So when we go to other emergency rooms, when we're in other places giving a conference talk or something like that, you're looking around and you're saying, this place is amazing, I would totally bring my child here. Or, this place is terrifying, and I'm so glad that Phoenix Children's doesn't look like this. So I think they're, you know, that benchmarking is something that the doctors do. It's something that people do, you just do with your own family when you go into a restaurant, that type of thing. So I think that our architects have to be, you know, cognizant of that.
People may wonder why we need a children's hospital, a children's trauma center, children's emergency. I wonder if you could relive your experience long before you became a physician and what you noticed.
Yeah, so this was, hopefully this doesn't happen to a lot of people, but when I was 17 years old, my brother was in a car accident over by the Tapatio Cliffs on 16th Street, and was brought into a local hospital that had a trauma center, and they did a great job, but he passed away in their trauma OR room. And I remember very distinctly being in a tiny little waiting room with my family, with no one really being able to update us. And every time I would just try to ask the, you know, police officer, what's going on? You know, I need to call my mom. My mom's not here. And he would say, you need to wait, because they're working on him right now. And that's all the information we got. So we are pretty aware, I am pretty aware of what a family would be going through when their patient, when their child is being worked on by me. And not only am I making sure that someone is looking after them, but I can tell you I try very hard to save their child's life. And that's something that I think the whole hospital knows that I do. Everyone at this hospital does that. This place is different in that we will do everything we can to keep your child alive. We will do everything we can to have a great outcome for your child. We have specialists who just specialize in neurodevelopment and neurotrauma, and having that available here is so different than everywhere else, that especially with a kid that's been in a really bad accident, they kind of have to come here.
Dr. Kathy Van Leeuwen is a pediatric surgeon at Phoenix Children's Hospital. We've been talking about PCH's $40 million project to increase the size of its emergency department and Level 1 Pediatric Trauma Center.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Arizona Community Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Alliance Bank of Arizona, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Catherine Fritke, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.